parts.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And Lynn Willey tries to get us to say that without the proper intro.
Which
means we can't do it. I mean,
Just say, jump in there and say your names. We can't say our names on command. This takes,
it takes
practice and
years
of
I've been watching
thought.
Grandchildren learn to say their names. And
it's hard.
They've been working on it for going on 2 years, and they still haven't quite got it down pat, you know, where they can say their whole name instantly on command. It's 2 years of practice. Or 2 years of something.
It's 2 years, at least. Two years of something.
And so it's a little hard to do that. Anyway, the telephone number in here, presuming that today is the last day of 2016, and it's around 11:07 a.m. where you are and you're in Central Time or whatever. Anyway, it's 11:07 here, and it's Central Standard Time in the United States. On December 31st. And if that's about the time it is where you are, then you can give us a call at the area code 254-773-1400 and join in our conversation. If it's some other time, you're welcome to call that number, but we won't answer.
Right. I wanted to talk about something that's a little bit of a segue from what we were talking about last hour. I wanted to talk about real estate.
As opposed to unreal estate.
Right. Virtual states are all in the computer. Unreal estate means it's all in your mind. Real estate. There is a strong opinion among many people, even after the Great Recession, that real estate is always a good investment if you just hold on to it long enough. That's like saying buying anything is always a good investment. There's a problem with the assumption. It doesn't matter the stock. You can't say that about any single company in the stock market. It's always a good investment. That's just not the case, because there are times when it's good and there's times when it isn't, and depending on when you buy it.
People do say stocks are good investments. Not necessarily.
Right. There's a lot of assumptions that have to be made there. Well-diversified, good management, low expenses. That sort of thing has to be implied. The same is true with real estate, and only more so, because real estate isn't intended, unless you are building something on the real estate, it's not intended to create extra value beyond what you paid for. So there's a simple premise at the beginning of this. You talked about gold at the end of the last hour, saying you're pessimistic on gold. It's the same concept. If you buy a stretch of land and 20 years later you sell the land, if you're somehow in vanilla average America, somewhere between all of, you know, the numbers added all together to get average, and average is not very realistic, but it's a good way of measuring things. You're likely to get back the taxes that you paid and inflation on the sale, which means you didn't lose money, likely.
But you have to pay taxes on the money that you returned without making any money. You have to pay taxes on the gains.
Right.
That aren't gains.
Unless it's a house you lived in, and right now you don't have to pay taxes on that. And that's why. Because the reality is that if you look at the fact that inflation is part of the gain, and you got to pay taxes on it, well, it means that you didn't make forward progress. There are exceptions. You were going to say something.
I was just going to give an example.
Okay, go ahead.
I just got through looking at the Consumer Price Index. Somebody had asked me about it, so I was glancing at it and realized that from my birth date, which was in late 1949, through the present, the dollar has decreased in value, in buying value, by 90%. So roughly, I was born just before 1950. So let's say 1950 to 2016, a 90% drop in value. That's a 10-to-1 issue. So if your daddy or granddaddy bought a ranch and paid $100,000 for it in 1950, and today you see it's valued at $1 million, have you had a gain on the property? And the answer is no. You've had a loss because you paid property taxes on it every year. If it was like $2 million, you'd be in a break-even position on paper.
Right.
Until you went to sell it and realized that of that $2 million...
You've got to pay taxes on...
You're going to pay a big chunk of taxes on the gains.
Depends on when Daddy passed away.
Right.
If Daddy passed away, you get this wonderful thing called a step-up in basis, where that's the day of the purchase in the mind of the IRS.
But you're going to basically... If it's come up to if the property went from $100,000 to $2 million in 67 years or 67 years, then you probably by the time you pay the taxes on it and you factor in the property taxes that were paid on it and everything else, you probably came pretty close to breaking even. But people feel like they're making a fortune.
Right. So that concept is there. Now, I said there are exceptions, and those exceptions are the reason why people feel like you can make a huge amount of money in real estate, because those exceptions are very real. You see what I did with the real thing?
I like that.
So those exceptions would be if you add value that people are willing to pay for.
But that's true in any business.
It's true anywhere, though. This is when we're talking about gold. You need to add value if you expect to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
If you're gambling, you don't add value, and you just hope that you can get it at the right timing. I'll sell it right at the right moment. If you're trying to run a business, and that's how you're trying to run your business, you're probably going to fail. If you're intentionally adding value to the thing that you purchase, and it's a value that you think other people will pay for, and that historically people have paid for that kind of value, then you can make a lot of money. And this is where the exceptions really occur, is if you take a piece of property and you build a house on it, and it's a good time to sell houses because people want to buy houses, then you can make a lot more money than you put into the property. That's key. That if you just think buying real estate, this is the thing I hear over and over and over again. They're not making more real estate. They're not making more land. Yes. Yeah. Well, you're sort of, maybe kind of, no, you're not true. That's not right. Look at Hawaii. Hawaii is growing. There is more land being made. Now, I realize that that's kind of a stretch for me to say, look at Hawaii when you're buying land in Texas. We have these long-term demographic trends that if you go back to the days when the railroad was first being put in, you'll start to see some of the trends, because you have these little villages that are pretty spread out, and then lots of farms that were about a day's wagon ride from the village. And the village really was just a couple of buildings, maybe a general goods store and an inn. Couple of, the farrier was there, the doctor was there. The place that, you know, the main services were.
Now, the farrier, that's where they made ferries?
Yes, that's where they made ferries. No, that's where they put the tires on the bottom of the vehicles. The shoes on the bottom of the horses. Not on the bottom, right, but okay. On the bottom of the feet. Now, yes, you put the shoe on
but
the
they didn't make
bottom,
ferries
it's
there.
Not good. No, they didn't make ferries.
Okay.
It's a farrier's thing, and
okay.
We'll have
they
that
made
conversation.
A lot of, they made a lot of sparks.
Right, right. So this concept was there. Then the railroad comes along, and people realize that if you were close to the railroad, you could be close to a lot more things, and you could have your connection to the greater civilization of the rest of the world. So we had this movement towards the small towns, but a greater movement towards the big cities. Because if you worked in a big city, you could combine all of these skills, and you could load them all up on the railroad, and it could be shipped wherever you wanted it to be. And then came the highways, and the city started shrinking again. The highways formed, and it caused the inner cities to decay, to slowly disappear as people spread out. And they went back, and this is when, if you're thinking about your personal history, it's the 1950s era, where people are moving into the suburbs, moving back to the villages of their youth, and those towns boomed, and they got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then since then, we've gone the other direction. Those towns have been sucked dry, and now they've moved out to the big cities again because there are other means of transportation. The airways are open, and we're shipping things. Well, and that means you need to be near an airport if you're shipping things by air, and you've got truck lines that are going on big interstate systems. And
you know, there's a to support your argument, it's one thing to say we can give all these statistics, but people emotionally, I think, still feel like if they buy real estate, they'll make money. But there's a way of countering that. If you live in Central Texas, if you live in the Temple, Belton, Killeen area, all you have to do is drive east into some of the towns, the little towns that are Holland and all the little towns that are scattered just to the east of here, and drive into the residential areas and look at the mansions. And you see these mansions that are literally falling down, and just look at that mansion that's sitting there.
When the people built that mansion, they said this is always going to be worth something.
But when you look at that and say, if that was a new building, and it was located somewhere that I'm familiar with, be it Killeen or Belton or Temple
or Austin.
And you look at this beautiful all-wood mansion, and if you went into it, in many cases, they would have no drywall in them. I mean, they're made out of handcrafted stairs. You say, wow, that would be $1 million.
Plus, maybe $2
property.
Million.
But let's just round figure, $1 million property. And in fact, if you look at the buying power it took to buy that mansion in Marlin, when it was built, it was the equivalent of $1 million in today's money. And you look at it today and say, yeah, you can lose money in real estate. The question that you have to raise is, why did people lose money there and make money in Austin? And Jake's talking about that.
Right. So this demographic trend, this movement, and if you think of a time-lapse footage that goes over centuries, and you're looking at big city, and if you see the population growth, kind of like breathing, it goes in and goes out, and it goes in and it goes out. And most of those inhales and exhales are long enough that the people even living in the middle of it don't notice it. It's just this city's always growing or this city's always shrinking. The same's true with the value of real estate. If you owned property in Marlin, at that point that you were there when Marlin was booming, if you had that time-lapse footage and you see the black and white pictures going on,
back in the black and white days before they had color,
it was a fantastic investment because you could create something of value in Marlin at that time. So real estate, the exceptions for good real estate investments have a lot to do with the long-term trends of what people are doing right now. Mm-hmm. We're about to hit another change. So right now,
two other changes.
Well, I'm going to say this clearly.
Okay.
the large cities are getting bigger. New York is growing, LA is growing, Austin is growing, Dallas is growing, Fort Worth is growing, Houston is growing. You've got these big, big, big cities, and they're getting big, 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 bigger. Detroit is an exception. They had one industry, the industry went belly up, and they all went away. Although, was a big exhale all at once.
Detroit started growing again.
It started to grow again, but it's got a long way to grow before it ever gets back to what it was.
Mm-hmm.
All of that growth trend has to do with the speed of transportation. So when highways were being developed and when the routes around the cities were being developed, you have all these suburbs that grew up. But now, if you live in Austin in a suburb, it's going to take you an hour and a half to get to work downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that people are trying to move closer to the inside of the city because the traffic is so bad, you got to figure out, how do you do this? Well, you stack houses on top of each other, and we'll call them a skyscraper, so that you just take the elevator. Well, now you have to wait to get on the elevator or wait to get off the elevator. So the traffic issue is really big. We're about to have that completely alleviated. This is one of those things I've talked about in passing before, but it's important to understand the self-driving cars, when they become the norm, when it's just abnormal to see somebody on the road driving, the car's not driving for them, that's dangerous. Why has that person got their hands on the wheel? And eventually, there's going to be laws against driving on the interstate highway yourself. Your car's going to do it, and you can't touch it.
I'm going to go so far as to say, why does that car have a wheel is what you
right.
look at.
Right. Why is it? They have a brake wheel? And an accelerator? That's really,
it's
really
dangerous.
Terrifying. You know, these people, you know, one of the absolute highest cause of death in people under the age of 25 is car accidents. I mean, if cancer was killing this many kids, we would be raising so much money to fight it that it'd be completely unbelievable. We all grew up knowing somebody who died in a car accident way too young, maybe lots of somebodies. Well, this new innovation is going to save a lot of people's lives, one. Two, it's going to change the way traffic flows. When computers are doing, and this is for bandwidth, those of you that remember the dial-up connection, what they were trying to do there is just slam as much data in a copper wire as you could fit and just cram it down there and try to make it go fast. And you had packet collisions going on. The information was banging into itself and corrupting itself. So they broke it down into packets, smaller and smaller packets, and put bigger and bigger spaces between those packets and made the packets go really, really fast. Instead of trying to cram them together, they spread them apart and just increased the speed tremendously. That's what's going to happen on the roads. Cars are going to be driving themselves. That means the roads are going to get less traffic as far as density goes. We're going to have a lot more cars going across the roads. They'll be going a lot faster. Well, that means that you can live further and further away from the big cities.
Yep.
That's the next demographic shift. Well, that means, well, then I should buy land in Salado, or I should buy land. No, because the other end of that demographic shift is going to happen too. If you're buying land with the expectation of doing nothing to that land but holding it, you're gambling. If you're buying land because you want to build a house on it and live in that house, know that you're probably going to break even on it. If you buy land and you put in the effort and you build the house and you know that there's a demand for the houses in that market, you should expect to make a profit.
And you're called a builder.
When you're called a builder.
Yeah, if you try to do it privately, you'll probably lose money.
Right. And that's something that people need to understand across the board. It's really hard to be well-diversified in local real estate because the word local just meant well-diversified went out the window.
And this is and I've said this over and over again. It only happened once since I've been in the business of providing investment advice. But it did happen once, and it probably will happen again, and that is how much of the Central Texas economy is dependent upon Fort Hood. And if the answer is, if Fort Hood were to leave, what would happen to the Central Texas economy? And people pretty much uniformly, what would happen to real estate?
Yeah, you said uniformly. I like that, you know, the Fort
Hood
thing.
Well, the point is that there have been other major military installations around the country that went away, lots of them. And if you look at the impact on the real estate locally, most of those still haven't recovered.
Right.
And when you have a single industry in an area, whatever it may be, the risk level of having any significant part of your wealth concentrated there for investment purposes is extremely high. Now, if I could change the subject.
Yes.
Okay, I want to talk about gold for just a moment.
Okay.
There is this perception that gold always keeps its buying power. Gold is always valuable. You should buy gold. It's a good investment.
Yeah, that's the perception.
And largely because it gets advertised a lot that that's true when it's just not. And if it were stocks or something that somebody was talking about, it'd be against the law. But with gold, they could say that. Now, here is a cold, hard fact. In 2011, gold prices hit $1,887 an ounce. At the end of 2016, gold prices are $1,157 an ounce.
That's like a $700 drop.
That's a very big drop in the price during a time frame when the S&P 500 returned pretty close to 10% a year. Now, what you say, well, yeah, but over the long term, well, actually, if you want an even higher price, you can go back to after you factor in inflation, because remember, gold doesn't have dividends. If you want an even higher price by factoring in inflation, you can go back to 1980 when it was even higher than $1,887. It never, matter of fact, if you bought gold in the 1980 to 82 timeframe and you factor in inflation, you're still waiting to break even. Now, had you bought gold 600 years ago, you've never come close to breaking even. And there's this concept, and I just got through seeing it in Market Watch, of all things, published by the same people who do the Wall Street Journal, that a column that says that's why the reasons that gold always holds its buying power.
Right.
Whoa, what? No.
No.
It's just simply not true. It doesn't hold its buying power. And this is there's economics, just like with land. In gold, there's economics behind it. Why did gold peak in 2011? Was there some crisis? Was there runaway inflation? No. The answer was, and we only see this in retrospect, in 2008 and 9, a lot of banks lost a lot of money, and a lot of people lost a lot of money because banks lost money. And in the third world, which developing world is, I think, what we call it now, India and China specifically, the fear that banks would collapse, combined with the fact that people had recovered enough that they had some extra cash to spend on gold, caused a lot of people in India and China to buy gold, and it peaked at 1,887. As the confidence returns in the banking system, people in those areas are selling gold, and guess what they're buying? As a more secure means, as a more secure wealth preservation asset, guess what they're buying?
What?
You know. Oh, dollars.
Dollars.
And if you look at what happened to the dollar since then, the rise in the dollar, there's all these mysterious economics about this is and that's and interest rates. Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. But one piece of it is people are converting gold into dollars because they consider gold to be too risky.
Right. And here's another thing that's happening, and this is great segue, because the Bitcoin is making a resurgence. What is the Bitcoin? Bitcoin is like this cryptocurrency. It's a currency that's a little bit weird. It has this great idea behind it.
I still don't completely understand it.
I'll explain it in a way that hopefully you'll understand it.
If you can do that, you'd be doing something impressive.
Okay. The idea was, well, that was a very strange sound. The idea was pretty simple. What does the dollar do? It doesn't create any value. It's just a thing. Just like gold is. So why should it be the thing that we use for currency? So someone, an unknown someone, said what we're going to do is we're going to trade encryption keys that nobody's looked at. So we're going to use this as a currency because it's valuable. You can use it to encrypt a communication once. And once it's been used, it's not valuable anymore. So it's basically a code. It's a code that nobody can look at or it becomes worthless.
Which is what I really don't understand. How do you know it's there?
Oh, well, you would have to look at it.
But as soon as you looked at it,
it's worthless.
It's worthless. So you're trading imaginary codes that nobody's ever seen.
Except there is a method that they're using. It's called a blockchain that says that nobody's looked at it. It's like the best form of dual entry bookkeeping ever because it's more than dual. Everybody's been keeping a record of that particular code. That code has an ID on it. It's never been used. And everybody peer-to-peer is saying that thing is never been looked at. So that's how you know, because everybody says it hasn't been looked
at. So everybody agrees that this imaginary object that nobody's ever seen is real and has value, and that's the reason it has value is because everybody agrees it has value.
Right, just like the dollar. So they went...
Nah, the dollar is backed by something.
Well, it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. It's the Bitcoin is backed by nothing.
It's got it. It's backed by nothing.
So what's the next thing about Bitcoin? Because I'm saying this. Bitcoin has been doing tremendously well as far as performance go. What's the problem with it? Well, the code that is supposed to be the valuable piece of it, it's an encryption. And in order to understand what encryption is, let's go back to the ones and zeros, binary code. One chunk of data, one little piece of data, or I'll even use the right word, one bit of data is either zero or one. So if you think about the on-off switch of your light in your room, if it's on, it's one. If it's off, it's zero. Okay. So that's one piece of data, one bit. When you get eight of them, it's called a byte. So that piece of data is stored, and machines use bits right now in their calculations. The code, think of it as a password. It used to be that if you had 16 bits in your password, this was really hard to break because computers were slow at the time. So 16 bits was going to take somebody years and years at present-day computing power to break it. Well, today, and just your typical laptop or even your iPhone, using your iPhone to crack a 16-bit encryption will take you less than a second if you have the right program running. It's just really, really easy to do. The Bitcoin encryption is at 256-bit. 256 is a long ways out there. That's 32 bytes. That's a really long password. Here's the problem with using that as value, because right now, 256 bit encryption is kind of the standard. If you're doing a credit card transaction online, it's 256 bits. Sometimes it's 512 bit. That's even better. I mean, that's going to take forever to crack. Here's the problem with it. It's a big one. Quantum computing is in its early stages. The Chinese just launched a satellite that uses quantum communication to send encryption keys so that they can send in the open encrypted communication. Quantum computing is such a leap forward in the speed of processors that it is really, 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 as I keep saying really a lot, hard to explain the huge leap forward. We're talking about exaflops now. Now, in your processor, what speed of processor do you have?
Really fast.
Okay, it's really fast. Your processor.
It's in the gigabytes, right?
Okay.
Or
gigabit.
Gigahertz.
Gigahertz. Okay.
Gigahertz.
Hertz just means number of times per second.
Right.
And giga means you're talking about billions.
Billions.
Okay. Exaflop takes that up, so trillion comes next, and then quintillion, and then the next step above that, sextillion, is the exaflop. So you're talking about multiple orders of magnitude difference, and that means that those computers exist today. The new AI deep learning computers that Google has and that China's working on and that Russia's working on exist today, which means less than 10 years, It's going to be in your laptop and maybe in your watch, or if we don't have laptops anymore, whatever we go to, that type of processing speed is going to be available, which means that the Bitcoin can be cracked in 30 seconds, not in 30 years. And that's if we only get the speed that's existing today out to the regular person and we don't continue to increase the speed dramatically.
Well,
which means that the value of the Bitcoin itself is based on a very temporary usefulness.
And I think that's reflected. I don't understand the economics behind Bitcoins other than speculation.
That's all there is. It's speculation, well, and people trying to get money out of China and out of Russia.
But suffice to say, you say it's been doing really, really well. November 30th of 2015, the Bitcoin price was $1,109.
Right, which is much less than it was at its peak.
Well, that was its peak on November 30th.
Yeah, November 30th of this year.
Of last year.
Last year, okay.
Okay, that was its peak. And January 14th, now there was November this is 2014 I'm talking about. In 2014, on November 30th, it was 1,109. On January 14th, 2015, it was $203.24. I'm looking at Coinbase.com, Bitcoin charts. It has since come back up to $943 per Bitcoin. But the point is, there's nothing – It's like gold, and I know that sounds really strange. It's like gold in that they are manufacturing of Bitcoins is slow, but people are adding Bitcoins into the system. But there's no real reason that it should be $1,000 and then 2 months later be $200 other than pure surges of speculation and advertising and somebody trying to corner the market. And you were saying Bitcoins are doing really well. I just think Bitcoins are crazy. Personally.
Yeah, I agree. I'm bringing this up because I'm hearing it. And let me tell you real quick, just so that you can understand that this is understandable. Would you say there's an infinite number of odd numbers?
Yeah, at least two of them are in here right now.
Okay, we're odd numbers. So the odd numbers go on forever. Are there more numbers that are not odd?
No.
Okay. So even numbers and odd numbers are the same amount forever.
Plus or minus one.
Okay. There are infinite amounts of even numbers and infinite amounts of odd numbers. But you add those two infinities together, you have a bigger infinity.
No, it's still just infinity.
No, it's a bigger infinity because there's more of it. This is provable.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. Infinity is as big as it gets. So
except, no, it doesn't.
Two times infinity is still infinity.
Wrong.
Okay.
You said something there that was utterly wrong mathematically. Infinity is as big as it gets. That's wrong. That statement itself is wrong. Infinity keeps getting bigger.
I'll take your word for it.
It isn't as big as it gets. It's just constantly expanding largeness. Okay. So the idea here is you can start to count prime numbers. Okay, one's a prime number. That's pretty easy. Three's a prime number. Five's a prime number. Seven's a prime number. Now they're starting to get further and further apart, though. Prime numbers get harder to find the further out you get. But you can keep finding them because we've got an infinite number of numbers out there. If you're using prime numbers as an encryption key, and you've got a computer that's just working on bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger numbers, constantly trying to find the next prime number, that's kind of like what Bitcoin miners are doing. The problem with it is that we're still using the one and the zero. That's a system that was developed by Leibniz, who was the compatriot of Isaac Newton. We're using 1600s technology to run our computers, except quantum computers don't use bits anymore. They use qubits, which are constant state fluctuation things that you can get any numbers between zero and huge number in the same space that on-off that one or a zero is. So all that is the mathematical proof that if you're investing in Bitcoins for the long term, expect to lose a lot of money. Short term, if you know it's gambling, you could make money, you could lose money. just like going to Vegas, only the odds are stronger against you.
There's a broker there someplace.
There's a broker that's
and
making
the broker
money.
Will make money either way.
Yes.
Yes. And if you trade through a broker, you will soon be broker.
Yes.
Which is why we're fee-only investment advisors. By the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And the telephone number to call in here, if you'd like to actually ask us a question about something to do with investing or economy that's a little less esoteric than the multiplying infinities, is 254, of course, 773-1400. And
we've got some commercials that we need to play. So let's go ahead and hit that.
So we can make some more Bitcoin.
Do you have some subjects you want to talk about when we get back?
Probably.
I've got some as well.
Okay.
It's amazing. We'll be able to fill the time.
All right.
All right, so until we're done with the break, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I wanted to talk about a couple of things, actually, since you asked me if I wanted to talk about a couple of things. One is that there is a massive economic experiment about to go on in several states in the United States and will be certainly worth seeing how well it works out. The biggest one is in Arizona, of all things. And what happens is in Arizona, minimum wage is going to go up $1.95 an hour, which is the biggest jump either dollar-wise or percentage-wise in the United States. Now, this is what's amazing to me. The Arizona legislature and its governor are conservative Republicans.
Wow.
And they passed – this is how the landscape has changed. The populist movement, which elected Donald Trump, says workers want more money. So the legislature said, employers, you pay the workers more money, which is, by the way, what the Democrats used to do. And if you look across the country, it is the Republican-dominated states that are leading the way right now in raising minimum wages, which is what the Democrats used to do.
Right. We this for us, the two of us watching this. This is a moment in history when the parties are shifting.
Right.
It's kind of beautiful. We're living in it, but it means that the landscape is shifting. And if you believe that conservative means better for business, it doesn't necessarily mean that anymore. It still can.
Well,
but the party is moving.
This is the I remember the Republican Party of the Rockefellers, and it was basically a business-oriented party that said you should lower taxes and cut deficits and make things easier on business. And if you made things easier, it was the Ronald Reagan concept of trickle-down economics,
right?
Where if you made things easier on business and you allowed them to hire more people, the economy would get better. Now it's reversed. It's really fascinating. But it'll be interesting. What'll be interesting is to see, and most people won't wait this long, but let's come back in a year or two and look at what happened economically to the state of Arizona, where they've done two big things. One, they have done a really good job of arresting people of Hispanic ancestry who shouldn't be in the United States. And they're fighting with the courts over that, and it'll probably continue. The other thing is they've done is they've raised the minimum wage. Now let's just see what happens to the economy of Arizona going forward. In the past, what we've seen is if you raise the minimum wage, you better have an ocean and some really, really nice scenery and some really, really nice climate like Washington State, where they've also raised the minimum wage,
or,
but they can get away with it because they've got lots of pretty scenery.
Right, or Hawaii, or there's places that they can – here's the thing. This is important.
Place where a lot of people want to live – don't care how much they get paid, but
I think,
if you raise the minimum wage there, a lot of people will come in.
Right.
Still.
I think people heard what you just said, and depending on their political position, implied your meaning. So there's a group of people out there that implied from your meaning, they were saying you are implying that this is a bad move by Arizona. And
no,
there's
it's
another,
just an experiment.
There's another group that say it's a great move based on their own political beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's wipe that out for a minute. Forget that. Take it away. We're looking at data. It isn't you, listener. We're not looking at your belief system. We're looking at what will happen in Arizona. And it's truly exciting to see something. I really enjoy not being a part of this kind of excitement because we've got some historical data that says it shouldn't work very well. But it doesn't mean it won't work, and that's part of the experiment. Every time we do it in a new set of circumstances, we can look at it and see what's going to happen here and gain more data from it.
Historically, if you live in a place that people really want to go to and wealthy people really want to live there and they're willing to employ people there because it's really nice.
Right. You could raise the minimum wage a lot.
And so you have a lot of jobs packed into a little area and very, very low unemployment. Then you can raise minimum wages and they'll just raise the prices of what they're doing. So cost of living goes up. Poor people move out.
Very great example of that right now is San Francisco. To buy a house in San Francisco, you need to have millions of dollars to do it, even if it's a tiny house. And Manhattan's another place. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're working at a coffee shop in San Francisco, your typical tip, not what you're paid, but the tip, if you were able to compare that to somebody in Minneapolis or in Illinois' tip, working even for the same chain of coffee stores, you're going to discover that you get tipped a lot more because people have more money there. It's concentrated in one area. If you raise the minimum wage there, it really doesn't have an impact because people aren't earning the minimum wage there anyway. They're already being paid more. When you force places to pay more when it wasn't already being set by the market, then prices are going to go up.
Well, there's a couple of offsets there. One is, and in Texas we do it extensively, using people and not paying them a minimum wage.
Right.
And generally those people are undocumented immigrants. But Arizona has done a lot of work towards eliminating the quantity of undocumented immigrants in Arizona.
Right.
And they just raised the minimum wage a bunch to make the workers happy so that the people who they elected will stay in office, which, by the way, I do have an objection to.
Right. And that populist concept of I'm going to give you a bunch of stuff even if we can't afford it so that you'll reelect me, I don't like that at all.
The concept of the government telling a business, ignore the market prices, just raise wages.
Right.
You must pay more money to people. You must, you know, there are certain things I won't object to too strongly, such as health insurance, because if I'm using a worker and I am going to use them up and throw them away because as soon as they get sick, they're gone. Yeah, there's some argument in saying, you know, you really need in a modern era where there's lots of health care available, but it needs to be affordable. And you've got a buying power advantage because you're an employer. Yeah, there's some argument there. I won't necessarily say I'm with it or against it, but there's an argument there. The concept of telling me that if I hire somebody off the street, I have to pay them a wage that makes it unreasonable for me to train them means, and I think we're going to see this happening across the country, and I've got some evidence on it, by the way, means that fewer people will get hired. Do you know, this is an interesting point. The largest number of businesses in the United States, 350,000 roughly. You know how many employees that particular set of business has? The largest set of businesses in the United States, they have zero employees. They are self-employed people who are making something. Now, I'm not talking about the people who are working on a construction site and you're self-employed. No, I'm talking about the self-employed manufacturers in the United States. There's 350,000 people who are in the manufacturing business who have no employees. And when the Wall Street Journal went around and surveyed them and asked them questions about that, why don't you have employees? The answer was the expense of hiring one person is prohibitive. So what they've done is they're finding ways to automate their manufacturing process rather than hiring an additional person.
Right. And this is very clear. If you raise the price to hire, people find ways to not hire. It's done for good reasons. The governments say, hey, people aren't getting enough money to live. Let's go for a moment.
The government should pay them money to live.
Well, where do they get the money? They got to raise the taxes. So I mean, let's go for
a
moment.
But that's unpopular.
In our minds, let's travel to France. The French government.
I can't understand what the people are saying here where I just traveled to.
Yeah, I'm very glad that they speak French over there or they'd have nobody to talk to.
Right.
So the idea here is the French government said, we're going to do something to help the worker and to help the common citizen. We're going to require companies to stop making their employees work so many hours. We're going to mandate a 30-hour work week. You cannot make your employees work more than 30 hours.
Is it 30 or 35?
It's different. They made changes to it, but it was originally 30. I think you can look it up. So they said you can't work more than 30 hours. The idea was, well, this will cause your employer, if you can only make one employee work for 30 hours, well, you got to hire somebody else to do the extra work. That was the idea.
It's 35.
35 hours. Okay, the idea is we got 5 hours that we got to fill up for the rest of the week. This, how are we going to do that? We got to hire somebody else. That's not what happened. People didn't hire people else. In fact, people fired existing employees because it costs more to hire somebody than to pay somebody that's already there. That cost of doing business just went up tremendously. And when you have standard of living increases, it makes sense to give raises to your employees if they're adding value. If they're not adding value, if you're in a competitive market, if you're trying to manufacture something and you're competing against China, and somebody says to you, you got to raise your minimum wage, well, that means you just go get a bunch of robots. If you're working at McDonald's and the minimum wage goes up, it means you're likely to lose your job because the computers are going to take over.
You know, and I can see some value in setting a minimum wage in a state.
Yeah.
But I think it needs to be flexible. For example, the minimum wage that you could live on in Bell County is much lower than the minimum wage you could live on in Travis County.
Correct.
And as soon as the government says
– cost of medication is a lot lower in Bell County than in Travis County.
So the point is that as soon as the government comes out and says across the board everybody must do this in business, it distorts the market and it, in my opinion, reduces employment. And firsthand, I've seen that actually happen where if you raise the minimum standard for employment and the amount that a business has to pay employees – the business has to reduce the number of people employed and find a way to automate that and become more efficient.
Right.
They hire fewer people.
Very recent example of the Affordable Care Act, or as some people call it, the Unaffordable Care Act, or Obamacare, or whatever. It's the AFA.
It should be called the UFA at this point.
It was labeled the AFA by Congress. Okay, the AFA. Aside all extra political names, whatever, requiring people that work a certain number of hours to receive employer paid for health insurance.
If you have a minimum number.
Right. If you have 50 or more employees, caused restaurant companies across the country to reorganize their companies into smaller units so that they had less than 50 employees, or if they couldn't do that, to fire a bunch of employees or to lower the number of hours they worked below 30 so that they didn't have to pay the extra expense.
Right.
Because their customers would not pay more money for the product that they were buying. So they had to shift in a different direction. This is, great idea. Let's help the world by causing the evil corporations to have to pay out money. Well, it's not the evil corporations that are the number one employers. The vast majority of people in the United States are employed by companies that have fewer than 50 employees. If you raise the expense there, they have less leeway. They fail a lot easier. It has a bigger impact than they think. And the corporations, big corporations, find a way around it.
And I'm really interested going forward. The repeal and replace of Obamacare with about 22 million people right now who have health insurance under Obamacare who can't get it elsewhere. I'm really, really interested in seeing
what the Republicans come up with, because this is the big question as to whether or not the opposition party, which has now become the majority party in Congress and in the White House, will actually be able to do anything. And the point here is, if that 22 million people, if it was just repealed, which is what a lot of people just want,
right, just repeal it, take it all away.
And you have 22 million people who suddenly don't have health care. A couple of things are going to happen very quickly within 2 years, and that is Congress, a lot of Congress people will lose their seats in Congress. And the other thing that will happen is the medical system will go nuts, because you'll have you'll have 22 million people who still show up in the emergency room and who won't be able to pay for the medical care that the rest of us will have to pay for.
It's basically what it was before. We had a broken system before. Oh, yeah. We have to admit that.
But the prices were going up very quickly.
Right. The fix to it is broken too.
That's correct.
So
what is the new fix? I'm hoping Paul Ryan can get the people together in the House of Representatives and they can come up with a decent bill.
Right. But that by definition, if it's going to be a good fix, this is an impossibility in some ways. It needs to be bipartisan. It means that people need to do it not on a political basis, but mm-hmm. what's going to be effective. That means that all of the insults that people are carrying around with them from the past, well, you did this without a single Republican vote. Yes, they did. And that was stupid. They are eating their hats right now going, man, I wish we hadn't done it that way. If the Republicans turn around and do the same thing, we're back to stage one.
We're going to
be a broken system again.
Yeah, and
we got to get it fixed, guys.
There's two opinions going on in the House of Representatives right now. One is fix it really quickly with something.
Yeah, that's
which is a really bad idea. And the other one is let it ride for a year or so and then fix it. We'll see how this works out. I hope they come up with something good, but we're out of time, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you would like to contact us off the air, we have live people during the week, voicemail during the weekend at 254-947-1111, or
you can reach at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, read our philosophy newsletters, listen to our podcasts. This is you can email us directly, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next year, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen.